Thank you, Rob. So we're going to have about 20 minutes of Q&A here on stage. We won't have any audience questions, but the good thing about economists is that we're very approachable. So I'm sure that any of the economists here would be happy once they're off stage if you have a burning question for them. So I'm going to start with Michael. We've always had a multi-speed economy in Australia. But I think the two-speed nature at the moment looks pretty stark if we think about the fact that unemployment in Victoria and New South Wales is the lowest we've seen since the 70s, whereas in WA here, as Rick has pointed out, it's pretty high. So do we have a two-speed economy problem, and what should the policy response be?
Well, I think we've got a series of two-speed economies going here, really, and it depends kind of what part of that story you're exposed to, how you answer and interpret that that question. So, for example, I think anybody that's kind of exposed to that Asian income story, so as I said in my talk, things like tourism and education, then it doesn't really matter what state you're in. It's going to feel like things aren't too bad, I would say. Clearly, if you're exposed to parts of the commodity story, well, that's where we've really seen the big swings from positives to negatives. But I suppose what strikes me about that side of things right now is that we're seeing a bit of a turn, or if you like, at the very least, the bottom is here. So that big decline in mining capex, mining construction activity that's weighed on states like WA in particular is pretty much to an end. And much to my surprise, at least some of those big iron ore companies actually have some expansion plans in place right now. You know, certainly things like the iron ore price are at levels that nobody expected only a month or two ago, and that's changing a lot of the dynamics again for states like Western Australia. Now, I'm not going to say the rivers of gold are returning here as they were back then, but some of those negatives are working their way through. How do you deal with that from a policy perspective? Well, now we've heard Reserve Bank say from time to time that they would love, for example, to have a different interest rate in different states. Because obviously states are at different parts of the economic cycle. Well, that's not actually possible to do. So in the end, it really comes down to fiscal policy. I think if there are significant divergences, then the way you fix it is by pulling the fiscal levers. And one policy that would help, I think, everybody at the moment, as I said at the end of my talk, well, now how do we reduce some of those consumer risks? Well, tax cuts would be a very effective way to do that in the current environment.
And so, Rick, you've suggested a very specific response to this in terms of payroll tax. That obviously has a fiscal implication for the state government here, and they've want to get back to surplus and pay down debt. How do you reconcile the two? What's the sort of cost of this, and how can it be paid for?
Yeah, it's a great question. How are we going to afford to do it? We're still heading towards $40 billion of debt. The interest payments on that debt for the state will be more than $1 billion each year, which is $1 billion you can't spend on nurses or teachers or schools or roads. So paying down that debt is the number one priority. However, if you look budget to budget, so in the mid-year update, every 6 months we get an update on how the state finances are tracking. In December there was the mid-year update, and it said that budget to budget we'll have more than just over $90 million more in payroll tax revenue between the two budgets than we expected. So the government can, if they were to increase reduce the payroll tax burden for small business in this upcoming budget, they could do it out of that additional revenue that they were expecting. So between the two budgets, there wouldn't be any additional cost. So they've got $97 million or so that they can spend there just from the increase in payroll tax revenue that's coming in from the top end of town. And you have to remember that in their first budget, the McGowan government increased the payroll tax burden on large businesses. So our biggest employers in the state had to pay either 0.5% more payroll tax or 1% more, depending on how big they are. So they're raising more and more revenue from businesses who are employing people, and we believe that they should give some of that back to small businesses to help them employ more people.
And just turning to you, Rob, you obviously speak a lot to foreign investors. How are they seeing the Australian economy at the moment? Pretty much since the GFC, been seen as a safe haven. Is that still the case? Have you seen a change in recent years?
So it's interesting that investors tend to treat their view of financial markets differently to the economy to a large degree. I have been meeting with investors offshore pretty consistently for the last 6 or 7 years, and the same theme for Australia comes through in terms of their concerns. One of them is our reliance and exposure to China as our single largest trading partner, and what would be the impact on Australia if China was to go through what people describe as a hard landing. The other is house prices, which from offshore, the growth in house prices in Australia looks absurd to a lot of investors and unsustainable. And I think in probably the last 18 months, I think the concerns would have heightened around the fact that the degree to which households are indebted in Australia, we've had flat income growth. They see this as potential real pressure.
Just want to turn now a little bit to business and consumer confidence. And something that you've said, Michael, is that consumers have become desensitized to good news and very reactive to bad news. Obviously, you know, the negative wealth effects of housing and weak wage growth are having an impact. Is there something deeper than this going on? How do we kind of get the animal spirits? Are some tax cuts enough? What's it going to kind of take to revive confidence?
Yeah, well, we think what we're really seeing here is just reaction to the long-running themes. So we know we've talked about household debt a few times today. Well, we've been concerned about high levels of household debt in Australia since last century. And we've worried about an overvalued housing market in Australia since 2004. If I look at the surveys the Commonwealth Bank does with its customers, their number one concern is job security, despite the, you know, the very good labour market that we've had. We've now had very weak income growth for households over 3 or 4 years. So you've got a whole array of negatives here that's been in play for quite a while, and that's what's changed consumer behaviour, I think, and potentially making them, yes, less sensitive to the good economic news, more reactive to the bad news. How could you change that? Well, some more income, I think, would help. And again, I'll come back to tax cuts as a policy lever that we could actually pull pretty quickly and pretty decisively, I think, as well. And you know, the usual rule of thumb when it comes to animal spirits is, well, tax cuts get spent three times when they're announced, when you get them, and then a third time just to make sure that you've done the job properly. So I think it would have a positive impact. But there is a risk, again, that, well, I've got some extra money. Should I just use it to pay off debt, or maybe I should boost my savings? Maybe I'm not going to spend it the way that tax cuts typically are. So it is a risk, but it doesn't mean to say we shouldn't try to do something along that front, I think.
And just taking this in the WA context, Rick, in your slides, based on the data that CCI collects, business confidence actually looks pretty solid at the moment. So I'm wondering what you think is missing in terms of this stop-start recovery that you're seeing here.
Yeah, I think that to put business confidence in WA into context, it's coming off an incredibly low base. So, you know, keep in mind the domestic economy has been contracting for the last 5 years. So businesses have been tightening their belts. We've got more people leaving the state than are arriving. Interstate migration's negative. So if you're a small corner shop, you've got less people walking the roads coming into your shop. The other thing is that the unemployment rate here is somewhat masked by the bigger picture, which is that as people lose their job and leave the state, they leave the unemployment rate figures as well. So for a small business, you've just got less people around, and that doesn't show up in some of these indicators. So for business confidence, it's steadily been growing. It's just under a 7-year high now. But if you think back over the last 7 years, that's been incredibly tough. But as we highlighted, they're still very concerned. Businesses are still very concerned about really weak demand growth for their services and for their goods, and they don't see a path out of that anytime soon. If we talk about 7-year high of business confidence, within that is still a third of businesses in Western Australia that think the economy is going to get worse. And the remainder think it's going to get better or be the same. So, you know, we're not overflowing with confidence here. It's just doing better than it has done after a difficult period.
And one of the things that constantly comes up in surveys, particularly for small business and confidence, is access to finance. And may have been overlooked, it was announced late last year that the Australian government set up an Australian Business Securitisation Fund. It's actually something that the AOFM have been working with Treasury on, Rob. I just wondered if you wanted to offer any observations on where that's up to and the design of that and the role that you're playing.
It's an interesting initiative, and in some respects it parallels our intervention in the RMBS market straight after the GFC. The AOFM was an investor in that market. In the RMBS market, you had a highly developed market with established mechanisms and good access to capital for small institutions other than the big banks. So the big banks were also relying on securitisation markets for access to capital at that time. But the lending for SMEs is a different prospect, as we see. We've been working with Treasury now for a few months on trying to better understand the industry and the nature of how our intervention might work or not work. It's a very underdeveloped market. It's about lending on an unsecured basis for small business, so the risks are high. And I guess the government has the view that, first of all, they'd like to see the supply or the availability of lending for SMEs to increase, but they would also like to see the cost of that lending fall. So there may be people in the room here who've faced the circumstances of going to get a loan on an unsecured basis and paying what would be, most of us would consider to be, exorbitant interest rates. So this is going to be an interesting challenge for us, because our approach to this is going to be to be an investor in securitised parcels of loans. So we won't be a direct lender to business. They'll be the existing lenders. They'll package up those loans. The banks will warehouse them, and then at some point they'll be released, and we will be an investor in those released securities. Now, the policy aim and our operational aim will be for us to do this in a way where we don't crowd out existing investors, because the last thing you want to achieve is a fledgling market to reduce all of the existing support and for government to step in and take over and then find no way to be able to get out. So one of the things that we have been pretty firm with the Treasurer on is that we need to be able to see some sort of exit strategy, because the government, as a policy decision, should be thinking about this as a transitory measure, not a permanent thing.
Thanks for that, Rob. We're getting close to time. Maybe just one final observation from you, Rick. You mentioned that you've just been to the US, interesting photo that you had from Detroit. It is obviously an incredibly diverse economy. I mean, what are the positive lessons, I guess, that you bring back from that experience to WA?
Yeah, there's a lot. And I'm sorry I brought the most devastating one into the room, but we can finish on a positive note. We went to Seattle. Seattle is an amazing tech hub in the US. A lot of Amazon's presence is based there. I went to visit the Amazon Go store, which is a retail store. It's just like a supermarket or a 7-Eleven type store. And you scan your phone on the way in, the doors open, and once you're in, there's no one else around. There's no staff inside. You walk around, and it tracks you with face recognition. It watches you walk around the shop. Anything you take off the shelf, it puts straight into your electronic basket on your phone, and then you just walk out the door, and it charges your credit card. So look, we debate here, you know, should Coles and Woolworths and every other big retail store be able to open before 11 o'clock on a Sunday? I mean, that debate's going to be gone because the technology is coming, right? And it's a great thing for consumers. It's a great thing because prices will be lower. People will be able to buy more groceries. Those on lower incomes will have a higher standard of living. So we're having debates here in WA which are just completely defunct because we're not open to the technology that is on the horizon. And that's, I think, where we need to shift our focus. It's just we're part of a much bigger world here, and we debate things too internally here in WA, and we need to look openly to the future.
That's a good note to end on. Can I ask you to join me in thanking the panel for their perspectives?